Challenges and Temptation. Part 6. Destructive Abundance. Chapter 17. Leadership Lesson 1. So goes the culture, so goes the company. A culture sacrificed. Long-term greedy. These were the words Gustav Gus Levy, the venerable senior partner at Goldman Sachs, would use to describe the way the company operated. The year was 1970, and Goldman was a gentleman's organization, one that believed in partnership and doing what was best for the client and the firm. Given their reputation these days, it sounds funny, but Goldman bankers were known as the billionaire Boy Scouts for their seeming desire to always try to do the right thing for their clients. Long-term greedy meant that sometimes it was worth taking a short-term hit to help a client because the loyalty and trust it produced would, in time, pay back in spades. And pay back it did. Like so many organizations with a strong culture, Goldman Sachs grew while rivals struggled or failed. Starting in the 1970s and lasting until the early 1990s, it seemed Goldman could do no wrong. Up until the 1990s, their reputation was very high, writes Susan McGee, a journalist and author of the book Chasing Goldman Sachs. If an IPO was underwritten by Goldman Sachs, that was akin to the Good Housekeeping seal of approval. While we must be careful not to romanticize Goldman's culture, just as we must not romanticize the Greatest Generation, there is no question that it was considered the gold standard on Wall Street. And as with all strong cultures, it was hard to get in. By hard, I don't mean the academic standards. I mean something even more difficult. There was a time when even the most academically qualified candidates could not count on getting a position at Goldman. They had to be a good fit for the culture. They were expected to put the needs of the firm above their own. The partners had to sense that they could trust their people even more than their people could make them rich. The people, in turn, had to believe in long-term greed. It was because their culture was built on these high standards of character that Goldman did well in hard times. While other crews were busy trying to save themselves, sometimes even abandoning ship, Goldman's people came together to see their ship through rough waters. But something happened. Starting in the 1990s, and certainly accelerating after the company went public in 1999, there's evidence that the partnership culture started to break down. The time was ripe for a new mentality to take hold at Goldman. The regulations that had kept finance boring had all but disappeared by the time Goldman IPO was issued, wrote Harvard law professor Lawrence Lessig in a column for CNN.com. Bold and sometimes reckless experiments, financial innovations created incredible opportunities for firms like Goldman to profit, wrote Lessig. In this atmosphere, the quickly expanding firm began to embrace a new kind of trader, a decidedly more aggressive personality than the investment bankers who had previously occupied the firm's ranks. The standards by which new people were brought in now put academic pedigree and prior success before cultural fit. The arrival of the new broker caused resentment amongst those who were proud of the company they had built and the culture they devoted their lives to uphold and protect, and the company split into two distinct camps, the old Goldman and the new Goldman. One culture was built on loyalty and long-term greed, the other built on numbers and short-term targets. One was built on a balance of social chemicals, the other built on an imbalance that was tilted decidedly toward dopamine. The more people Goldman let in who were driven to maximize their own wealth and status, sometimes at the expense of the firm or the client's long-term advantage, the more damage it did to the culture of the company, its overall reputation, and ultimately the decisions the firm made. William Cohen highlights in his book, Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. The first time Goldman had actual layoffs, as in fired people because the firm was having a bad year, as opposed to for individual performance reasons, was in the early 1990s, and it was highly traumatic, Cohen writes. Think about that. Goldman Sachs did not embrace the concept of layoffs until the 1990s. Something had clearly changed. By 2010, with Goldman Sachs' role in the mortgage-backed securities crisis, coupled with the huge bonuses it gave out just months after receiving a government bailout, the company's tarnished reputation was at its lowest point. It was no longer the most trusted firm on Wall Street, but rather a symbol of its excess and greed. Its CEO, Lloyd Blankfein, even issued an apology. "We participated in things that were clearly wrong, and we have reasons to regret and apologize for," he said in November 2009. But it was too late, and half-hearted, many felt. No longer called the Boy Scouts, the Goldman Sachs leaders were considered something closer to crooks. This story is not unique to Goldman Sachs. I use Goldman to illustrate what is happening in a good too many of our companies across all sorts of industries. Every culture has its own history, traditions, languages, and symbols. When we identify with a culture, we articulate our belonging to that group and align ourselves with a shared set of values and beliefs. We may define ourselves, in part, by the culture of our country of citizenship, for example. I am an American. Or by the culture of an organization, such as I am a Marine. This doesn't mean we think about our cultural identity on a daily basis. But when we are away from the group, or if our tribe is threatened from the outside, it becomes more important. It can even become our primary focus. Remember how the country came together as one after the events of September 11th. In strong corporate cultures, employees will form similar attachments. They will identify with the company in a very personal way. The employees of WestJet, Canada's rebellious populist airline akin to America's Southwest Airlines, don't say they work for WestJet. That would make it a job. They call themselves WestJetters. It's an identity. When we don't have a sense of belonging, we wear a T-shirt stamped with the company logo to sleep in or while painting the house. When we have a sense of belonging, however, we wear the company swag in public with pride. When cultural standards shift from character, values, or beliefs to performance, numbers, and other impersonal dopamine-driven measurements, our behavior-driving chemicals fall out of balance, and our will to trust and cooperate dilutes. Like adding water to a glass of milk, eventually the culture becomes so watered down it loses all that makes it good and healthy. And by then, it only looks like or vaguely tastes like milk. We lose our sense of history, of responsibility to the past, and of shared values. We care less about belonging. In this kind of weak culture, we veer away from doing the right thing in favor of doing the thing that's right for me. To work for Goldman Sachs used to mean something more. It wasn't just a description of a place of employment. For those who fit the culture, it said something about what kind of person they were. It told the outside world what they could expect from them, and it was largely positive. A person could take pride in the association, but the leaders of the company didn't protect what took so long to build. As Goethe, the great 19th century thinker, reportedly summed up, "You can easily judge the character of a man by how he treats those who can do nothing for him." If character describes how an individual thinks and acts, then the culture of an organization describes the character of a group of people and how they think and act as a collective. A company of strong character will have a culture that promotes treating all people well, not just the ones who pay them or earn them money in the moment. In a culture of strong character, the people inside the company will feel protected by their leaders and feel that their colleagues have their backs. In a culture of weak character, the people will feel that any protection they have comes primarily from their own ability to manage the politics, promote their own successes, and watch their own backs, though some are lucky enough to have a colleague or two to help. Just as our character defines our value to our friends, so too does the culture of a company define its value to those who know it. Performance can go up and down. The strength of a culture is the only thing we can truly rely on. It's always fascinating to pay attention to the words people choose when describing their relationship with their jobs. Words like love and pride are feelings associated with oxytocin and serotonin, respectively, or in the case of Goldman Sachs, the lack thereof. "I don't feel safe," a current employee at Goldman Sachs told me. "I could lose my job at any moment. Goldman has no heart," she said. That she would say a company has no heart is a recognition of the lack of empathy in the culture. And when empathy is lacking, aggression, fear, and other destructive feelings and actions dominate. A former Goldman employee who worked at the firm in the 2000s, well into the cultural transformation, described an atmosphere of ruthlessness. with managers pitting one team of advisors against another as they fought for a project or client. He described an environment with no trust, no mutual respect, and above all, no accountability when things went wrong. The environment was one of win at all costs, even if it meant squashing a coworker, not to mention a client. Not surprisingly, despite the status one got from working at Goldman, a status probably built from the venerable years before, the former employee and nearly all his colleagues left for other companies within 2 years. It was just too much for a human to put up with if they wanted to maintain their sanity and be happy, if not successful. But the leaders allowed this culture to continue. On March 14, 2012, the New York Times carried an editorial by Greg Smith, then an executive director of Goldman Sachs, in which he announced his immediate resignation from the firm, where he had worked for 12 years. In it, he wrote about the firm's toxic culture. The culture was the secret sauce that made this place great and allowed us to earn our clients' trust for 143 years. It wasn't just about making money. This alone will not sustain a firm for so long. It had something to do with pride and a belief in the organization. I'm sad to say that I look around today and I see virtually no trace of the culture that made me love working for this firm for many years. I no longer have the pride or the belief. Leadership used to be about ideas, setting an example, and doing the right thing. Today, if you make enough money for the firm and are not currently an axe murderer, you will be promoted into a position of influence. When the history books are written about Goldman Sachs, they may reflect that the current chief executive officer, Lloyd C. Blankfein, and the president, Gary D. Cohen, lost hold of the firm's culture on their watch. When we assess how we feel about our jobs, we are often responding to the environments in which we work. It's not just about the work we're doing per se. And when a culture changes from a place where people love to work into a place where they go to work simply to take something for themselves, the finger gets pointed at the people who run the company. People will respond to the environment in which they operate. It is the leaders who decide what kind of environment they want to build. Will they build an inner circle around those closest to them, or will they extend the circle of safety to the outer edges of the organization? The vast majority of people who work at Goldman Sachs, despite what some critics would like to believe, are neither bad nor evil. However, the environment their leaders have created for them to work in makes it possible for them to do bad or evil things. As humans, our behavior is significantly influenced by the environments in which we work, for better and for worse. In November 2008, terrorists armed with automatic weapons attacked various sites in Mumbai, India, killing over 160 people. The Taj Mahal Palace Hotel was one of those sites. What makes the story of the Taj extraordinary, however, is that their employees risked their lives to save the guests. There are stories of telephone operators who, after having made it out safely, ran back into the hotel to call guests to help them get out. There are other stories of kitchen staff who formed a human shield to protect the guests as they tried to escape the carnage. Of the 31 people who died at the hotel that day, nearly half of them were staff members. Rohit Deshpande, a Harvard business professor who researched the events at the Taj, was told by senior management at the hotel that they couldn't explain why their people acted so bravely. But the reason is not elusive. It was the result of the culture those leaders had cultivated. One of the finest hotels in the world, the Taj insists that their people put the interests of their guests before those of the company. In fact, they are often rewarded for doing so. Unlike the culture of Goldman Sachs these days, at the Taj, grades and pedigree play less of a role in how they select their people. They've learned that graduates from second-tier business schools, for example, often treat others better than those from top-tier business schools. And so they prefer to hire from the second tier. Respect and empathy are valued over talent, skill, or motivation for personal advancement. Once hired, the staff's inclinations are reinforced and encouraged, which in turn builds a strong culture in which people can be trusted to improvise rather than do things by the book. The Taj knows its people will do the right thing, not the thing that's right for them. So goes the culture, so go the people. I'm always struck when a CEO of a large investment bank is shocked to learn that there was a rogue trader in their midst who, in pursuit of personal gains or glory, made decisions that caused damage to the rest of the company. What else should we expect from a culture that reinforces and rewards self-interested behavior? Under these conditions, a CEO is basically gambling that their people will do the right thing. But it's not the people who set the course, it's the leadership. Bad cultures breed bad leaders. Kim Stewart was just one of the many employees who suffered as a result of a toxic environment. She knew on her first day at Citigroup that there was something wrong with the culture. I remember I came home and I told my husband, I have to limit the number of smart things I say. The problem wasn't that she thought her boss or her colleagues were stupid, but rather that they felt threatened, a perfectly valid feeling to have in an organization with a weak circle of safety. There seemed to always be an air of suspicion and mistrust at the office. Stewart recalls that when she first joined the investment banking division in 2007, she immediately set out to understand the way the company closed certain kinds of deals. She went to her boss and asked him to confirm her understanding of the process, which he did. So why was her first deal an embarrassing disaster? Stewart later found out that her boss, concerned that her success might threaten his own status, intentionally left out a key part of the deal-making process, ensuring she would bomb. It was as if he wanted her to fail in order to make his performance look better. At Citi, Stewart says, the feeling was, I don't want anybody to know as much as I do, because then I'm expendable. This is a behavior designed for nothing but self-preservation. It is a classic symptom of a cortisol-rich, unsafe culture where valuable information is hidden to advance or protect an individual or small group, even though sharing would benefit the others in the group and the organization as a whole. Everybody feared being one-upped by a colleague, Stewart recalls. Nobody felt safe. And not because the company needed to make cutbacks. It was simply the culture. It would be another year before the company would suffer enormous financial losses, leading to its rescue by the federal government, in large part due to an atmosphere of hoarding information rather than sharing it. One cannot but wonder how the financial crisis would have turned out had more of the banks had healthier, chemically balanced cultures in which the people didn't feel threatened by each other. Of course, cutbacks did come eventually. In November 2008, the company had one of the single largest rounds of layoffs on record in any industry in history. On one day, Citi issued 52,000 pink slips, amounting to about 20% of its workforce. Stewart's department was cut by more than half, down from 190 to 95, and bonuses were slashed. Once the dust settled, you would think the leaders of the organization would have been humbled, but they weren't. Instead, the atmosphere got worse. Stewart recalls that in late 2011, a few years after the crisis, when the company was back in the black, her new boss at Citi, a managing director, arrived to introduce himself. He told the employees he was interested in only three things: revenue, net income, and expenses. Then he added privately to Stewart, "If you think I'm going to be your mentor and give you career advice, you're wrong." So goes the leadership, so goes the culture. A culture protected. Most people are familiar with post-it notes, but what most people do not know is how they came to be. Unlike so many companies that develop products by imagining and trying to build them, 3M owes the development of post-it notes and so many of its other products to one simple thing: its culture of sharing. Spencer Silver, the scientist who is partially credited with the creation of the post-it note, was working in his lab at the Minnesota-based company, actually trying to develop a very strong adhesive. Unfortunately, he wasn't successful. What he accidentally made was a very weak adhesive. Based on the job specs given to him, he had failed. But Silver didn't throw his failure in the trash out of embarrassment. He didn't keep his misstep a secret out of fear for his job or guard it closely in the hopes of someday profiting from it. In fact, the unintentional invention was shared with others at the company, just in case someone else could figure out a way to use it. And that's exactly what happened. A few years later, Art Fry, another scientist at 3M, was in church choir practice, getting frustrated that he couldn't get his bookmark to stay in place. It kept falling off the page, off the music stand, and onto the floor. He remembered Silver's weak adhesive and realized he could use it to make the perfect bookmark. And that was the birth of what would become one of the best recognized brands in history, with 4,000 varieties sold in over 100 countries. Innovation at 3M is not simply the result of educational pedigree or technical expertise. Innovation is the result of a corporate culture of collaboration and sharing. In stark contrast to the mindset of the leaders at some investment banks, 3M knows that people do their best work when they work together, share their ideas, and comfortably borrow each other's work for their own projects. There's no notion of mine. In another company, Silver's botched formula might never have made its way into Fry's hands, but not at 3M. At 3M, we're a bunch of ideas, Fry is known to have said. We never throw an idea away because you never know when someone else will need it. The cross-pollination of ideas, combined with an emphasis on sharing across product lines, has led to an atmosphere of collaboration that makes 3M a place where employees feel valued. Innovation from interaction is one of the company's favorite mottos. Employees are encouraged to present new ideas at internal tech forums, regular gatherings of peers from other divisions. One sure sign that all this collaborating is working is that more than 80% of 3M's patents have more than one inventor. This kind of culture has nothing to do with the kind of industry 3M is in. Even an industry that is less collaborative by nature of its products or services can benefit from sharing. Huge improvements can happen just by getting a fresh set of eyes on the work. Hearing one person's solution to a problem can inform someone else how to solve a problem of their own. Isn't this the idea of learning? To pass on our knowledge to others? Take a look at the products 3M develops, and you will be amazed how their innovation leaps from one division to another. Scientists in a 3M lab developing products for the automotive industry set out to create a substance that would help auto body shops mix the filler they used to fix dents. The technology they used came from a 3M lab for creating dental products, from a substance dentists use to mix the putty for dental impressions. In another example, a 3M technology used to brighten highway signs would later be used to invent micro-needle patches, which allow injections to be delivered painlessly. The cross-pollination of ideas produces innovation to a degree that would make most people's heads spin. The company has over 20,000 patents, with over 500 awarded in 2012 alone. In 2009, in the middle of a very tough economy, when other companies were slashing their R&D budgets to save money, 3M still managed to release over 1,000 new products. 3M's products are ubiquitous, though typically unnoticed, and almost always taken for granted. If everyday products had a 3M inside sticker on them, like computers had an Intel inside sticker, the average consumer would see that sticker 60 to 70 times a day. 3M has succeeded not because they hired the best and the brightest, though I am sure they would argue that they do, but because they have a corporate culture that encourages and rewards people for helping each other and sharing everything they learn. Though 3M surely has its share of problems and bureaucracy, they work very hard to foster collaboration. Inside a circle of safety, when people trust and share their successes and failures, what they know and what they don't know, the result is innovation. It's just natural.